It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. For Ben Kiefer, I'm Ben Stanton. As we do most Fridays, we have a News Buzz program for you. We run through usually about half a dozen news stories and other items that we hope you find interesting and informative. In the second half of the program, we'll hear about March Madness. NCAA men's and women's basketball tournaments are starting. Bryce Miller from the Des Moines Register will be on to talk through the Iowa and Iowa State teams. We'll have a sled hockey player on who just returned from Sochi, Russia, and the 2014 Paralympic Games. Andy Yohe from Bettendorf is the team captain for the gold medal U.S. sled hockey team. And in a few minutes, we'll have two topics related to agriculture, farm safety in light of a recent farm fatality, and the efforts to use drones, unmanned aerial vehicles, on farms. But to start things off, Iowa is one of three states given an all-vet state designation. Michigan, Tennessee, and Iowa were chosen by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation, which is an affiliate of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. After the announcement, Iowa Governor Terry Branstad said that the state is, in his words, dedicated to making Iowa a home for the nation's returning heroes. Joining me to briefly talk about opportunities and challenges for Iowa's veterans is Colonel Robert King, Executive Director for the Iowa Department of Veterans Affairs. Colonel King, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Ben. How you doing?
Just fine. Thank you for joining us for the program.
You're welcome.
And congratulations.
Thank you very much.
What's it mean to you that Iowa received this recognition?
Well, this is huge. Being recognized as, you know, with the other two states, Michigan and Tennessee, as an all-vet state, you know, just truly shows the support that the state is giving to the veterans and their families. We are very, very dedicated to making Iowa a home for all the returning veterans, and that's not only the ones that, you know, have recently come home from the multitude of deployments, but there's also in the next several years a number of military men and women that will leave the services because of drawdowns and because of just, you know, the time that they've, you know, they're ready to get out of the military, and others are going to be retiring. And we want to set Iowa in a state where we're recognized as one of those states to come to. We're, you know, a state that's very friendly to veterans, a state that is providing opportunities, and a state that welcomes them and is helping them be the place where those veterans can come to live, to work, and to raise families and be part of the communities.
We'll talk about the transition. What is the transition like for an Iowa veteran returning home in general? Can we make a general characterization of how that works? Everyone's different, but what are some similarities across the board?
Well, I'm not one of them, so I can't speak from experience. But, you know, you got a situation where you're leaving one type of life. You know, you've had a career path that was very organized, very strict. You're leaving that. You're coming into a completely different housing environment, a completely different community environment, looking for jobs, placing children in different schools, finding housing, assimilating into a new community, you know, finding a new church home, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of pieces to it. And what we think that this designation does for us, along with the Home Base Iowa initiative that has been in place for a few months, it just sets us apart from the other states. And I recognize very well that a number of states are doing different programs. They're doing various types of legislation in order to draw veterans to those states and be recognized. Certainly, the designation by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation certainly sets Iowa apart as being one of the leaders at this point in the things that we're doing to attract those veterans and their families and help them transition into the Iowa communities.
Well, and you said you didn't have the experience of being a veteran returning home, but you did serve in the Iowa National Guard for decades. And,
yes, I did.
And thank you for that service. But you, surely during that time, you've met a lot of veterans. And, of course, in your job now as Executive Director for the Iowa Department of Veterans Affairs. But what's changed in decades about what veterans need?
I don't think anything's changed. You know, I listened to my father-in-law talk about coming home from World War II. I've listened to uncles talk about coming home from Korea. I've watched, you know, young men and women and older men and women come home from the deployments of the Gulf War and more recently the Iraq and Afghanistan. it doesn't change at all. You know, they've gone, they've seen things occur there. They've been part of a different culture for 12, 18 months. They come home and they have to assimilate themselves into the communities. And sometimes they bring some burdens with them that they and we as a community have to help them deal with. But we think that, you know, Home Base Iowa and this all-vet state designation goes a long way to paving the way for at least one part of that, and that's helping them find a job, have a job. And there's a number of Iowa businesses who have stepped up to the plate. They got themselves designated as Home Base Iowa businesses, which in that they pledge that they're going to hire a specific number of veterans. They commit themselves to posting their jobs on our website, which is one, you know, we think is a really neat one-stop shopping center for Iowa or for veterans to look at to see all the opportunities that are here. And, you know, I'm just very, very proud to be part of this program that is reaching out to those veterans and helping to care for them. And of course, that's the mission of my department, to care for veterans and their families.
You mentioned some of the burdens that veterans might have, and we do hear stories about the mental and social transition. We hear about PTSD and those challenges. So what's the first step to addressing those challenges?
Well, the very first step is for them to get involved into the system and to sign up for benefits, which they can do when they're, you know, upon discharge. Because I know, because I've done the briefings myself for the returning guardsmen that have came back since I've been in this position, then go to the treatment and, you know, whether it be at the VA Med Center or whether it be at the Vet Center, the new one here on 22nd Street in West Des Moines. But there's a number of places in the system that can help them deal with the issues that they have.
What are the special skills that veterans would bring to an employer?
Well, knows what a schedule is, knows when he has to be to work, appearance, moral character, crime-free, shouldn't be using drugs, shouldn't have an alcohol addiction. You know, they're the things that an employer wants when somebody walks in the door for an interview. They have the skills that, you know, an employer will want, and kind of places the veteran above everybody else. And to that end, more than that, they come with skill sets. And one of the things that's available for these men and women when they go to the Home Base Iowa website, they can go down through that and they can find places in there to help with resumes. There's a place, Ben, where you can actually type in your military occupational specialty. I was a military policeman years and years and years ago, more than a couple decades, and typed in 95B, which is the military occupational code for a military policeman, which I was, and up pops about a dozen different job opportunities based on that. It tells you what it is. It tells you what community they're in. There's a link there to go to that and make the application. So we've made it as simple as we can make it. I'm really happy with it. And another item that I would like to make a comment about is that there's a lot of community veterans job fairs. We are working together with the Iowa Business Council and the Central Iowa Trades Council, and we're going to do a large job veterans job fair at Camp Dodge on the 24th of April. That's a Thursday. It's going to be in the Freedom Center, which is right inside the gate. But these companies that are coming here, along with the trade councils, are coming with jobs and careers. They, you know, many of them have positions that they'll hire on the spot. So we encourage anybody, any veteran that's listening or family members or friends of a veteran that's looking for, that's unemployed or underemployed, to come to the job fair.
Okay, thank you. Good luck with that job fair. Again, that was April 24th. And thank you so much. And congratulations again on the All-Vet State recognition by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation for the state of Iowa. Colonel Robert King, Executive Director for the Iowa Department of Veterans Affairs, thanks so much for talking with us today.
You're welcome, Ben. Have a good day.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Stanton, and for Ben Kiefer. It's our News Buzz edition of the program on Fridays when we run through a number of items that are in the news that we haven't gotten to otherwise. Well, in northeast Iowa, a farmer apparently fell from a grain trailer and was killed. On Monday afternoon, 75-year-old Donald Riley was working at his farm in Coggin, Iowa, when it happened. It's not unusual for us to hear a story like that. There are deaths on Iowa farms every year, either from falling, grain bin entrapment, tractor rollovers, and other incidents. So how common is this? What precautions are generally practiced? And what rules are in place? What can we do to prevent these fatalities? Well, Iowa Watch, the nonprofit public affairs journalism outlet, recently put together a series of stories, data gathering, and investigation. Joining me now to talk about that is Lauren Mills, reporter and digital analyst for Iowa Watch. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Why don't you talk about what went into this investigation? What were you looking for when you first started?
Sure. So with this investigation, what we were looking at was farm fatalities. So when an accident happened that results in a death on a farm, and what we looked at were occupational fatality rates, which are collected by the University of Iowa and the College of Public Health. And farm deaths, we found, were the highest occupational fatality. So more than transportation, more than any other occupation. In numbers, it doesn't seem too terribly large. It's 25 deaths a year. But when you look at it in that terms, it's pretty large, pretty significant.
And significant because we're also talking about, in some cases at least, deaths that might have been prevented.
Exactly, yeah. The most common factor that we found was a lack of ROPS, or rollover protection, on tractors. Tractors made after 1985 are required to have this, but older tractors do not. And basically what it does is if a farmer's in a tractor that rolls over, it will protect them from the weight of that tractor up to, I think, three times. So it's been proven incredibly, incredibly, useful, and it protects the farmer, prevents any sort of injury or fatality. And it's easy to install, but a lot of times farmers, they like the antique look of their older tractors, or, it would make storing them more difficult, or, it's an expense. It's about $1,000 to add one of these, so they don't do it. And it's also kind of a mindset that farmers have because they've often been working on the farm since they were a kid. They've gone out on this tractor so many times. They've been up in the grain bin so many times. So when we were speaking with farmers, they were saying, well, it might happen to my neighbor, but it won't happen to me because I'm careful. But the title of our series that we did on farm safety was A Matter of Seconds, because it really only takes, one wrong step, 1 second of being distracted to cause fatality.
And not just the fact that it only takes seconds, but many times farmers might be working in isolated areas, I would imagine.
And so people don't find them for a long time or don't notice that they're missing for a while. And then by the time the rescuers get there, it's often too late.
There are some rules through OSHA, but that doesn't apply to all farmers. You have to be a certain size farm, I take it?
Right. I believe it's over 11 workers. A lot of times the smaller farms in Iowa, which, there are a bunch of smaller farms, they kind of slip under the radar until something actually happens that results in a serious injury or a fatality.
Looking at some of the information from your reporting, the number of fatalities last decade is lower than that of the 1990s. So do we know why that is the case?
Well, I mean, there are, improvements. ROPS are now required on tractors.
And people are apparently using them.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a new tractor, you have ROPS. I mean, it comes standard now. It's just with the old tractors updating them. And people have started adopting some of the safety devices, but it's slow going.
Well, there was a lot of data to gather to get this information. How did that process happen? Was information about farm fatalities easy to find?
So when there's a fatality on a farm, it gets reported. And the University of Iowa College of Public Health puts it into a database. It's called the FACE program, the Fatality Assessment and Control Evaluation Program, which is a bit of a mouthful. But they actually do a great job of, gathering at least the main details about an event, where it happened, what the occupation was of the victim. What we tried to do was gather a little bit more information. Sometimes it didn't say whether, if there was a tractor rollover, whether or not ROPS was a factor, or lack of ROPS was a factor. So we did have to do a little bit of digging with that.
Well, look ahead with this a little bit. As this equipment is continuing to be more common and installed on new tractors that are being bought, so will we continue to see a decline? Do we know how to look forward? Are there other measures, other efforts that are going to need to be put in place?
There are definitely other efforts that need to be taking place. One major discussion among safety activists and farmers is whether there should be regulations, greater regulations, or whether some sort of incentives program, kind of a rewards for having a safe farm, would be a better way to go about it. Because, I mean, when we're talking to farmers, they're saying, we don't want more regulations. We don't want to have more rules that we're trying to meet. But, having them be rewarded for, you know, putting ROPS on the tractor or installing a harness system for the grain bins might be taken a little bit better.
Thank you for coming in to talk to us about it.
Sure.
That's Lauren Mills, reporter and digital analyst for Iowa Watch, and some of that reporting can be found online, iowawatch.org. We'll have a link to that on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. This is a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Stanton, and for Ben Kiefer, it's a News Buzz edition of the program. Quick hits on a number of items during the course of the hour. Well, if you hear someone say they see a drone flying overhead, that might give you a certain sensation or maybe even fear, probably because that word drone makes us think of war. But there are many uses for these unmanned aerial vehicles. One of them, potentially, that could be lucrative and useful domestically, is in agriculture. Well, joining us now, Peter Gray, reporter with Harvest Public Media, joins us. He's from WUIS in Springfield, Illinois. He's going to be talking a bit about how tech-savvy farmers might be using these drones. Peter Gray, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
I'm glad to have you on the program. Your story, Drones Coming Soon to a Farm Near You, is online, available at iowapublicradio.org if you've missed that report. And I should say Harvest Public Media is a collaboration between Midwest public radio stations, including Iowa Public Radio. So what do these aerial vehicles that farmers might use, what do they look like?
You know, visualizing these is difficult to do because they are very different, but I think that the first thing that we should do is just kind of divide them up between fixed-wing aircraft, which look like, it looks like a model plane that a hobbyist might fly, and then there's those vehicles that are called quadcopters, and sometimes they're more than just four blades, like the name would suggest. But these quadcopters, which were developed primarily out in California for filmmakers, are now making their way into ag, as we've mentioned, and are really attractive to farmers who want to get just up above their crops or their cattle, even, to see, you know, how things are looking.
Really talking about a small, almost like remote-controlled helicopters with a camera on it.
Yeah, it's precisely that, and we're talking about a fraction of the cost versus paying a pilot to do these kinds of scouting missions or just crop spraying. There's a couple of applications that industry folks really want to get into, and that's, you know, remote sensing, insect damage, and also precision applications. You know, eventually wanting to take this into the area of crop dusting and fertilization or spraying. But they're a long way away from that. However, nations like Japan have already been doing a lot of their crop dusting with remote-controlled helicopters, for example. So there's a huge market for it. At least the trade group that represents manufacturers, they put out this economic impact report last year suggesting that between the years of 2015 and 2025, the industry is going to generate something like $82 billion. So they're talking about it becoming as much as an $82 billion industry potentially as we move into 2025. But again, it all depends on FAA and what those regulations may be, and we expect that we're perhaps going to see some small unmanned aerial vehicle application for rural areas, some special rules for that out later this year.
Clearly, farmers are interested in using these since there is a market. So what is the legality of these, say, in the Midwest here?
Yeah, that's a real sticky issue for folks, for regulators. I spoke with a gentleman with FAA who stressed that anyone who wants to operate a drone for commercial use, in other words, if I'm a farmer and I've got a neighbor who wants me to scout their fields or, you know, check for flooding, et cetera, and I charge him $8 an acre to do that, I'm technically breaking the law. So there's the legality when it comes to the commercial use, and then there's also the legality of how these unmanned vehicles will share the airspace, which is FAA's primary concern. It's a public safety issue. Right now, these vehicles can be flown under 400 feet, so you can get up over your field and operate as a hobbyist. So it is something that farmers can have as sort of an added value application to something that, you know, they may be doing already. But FAA and the people who are close to the industry are stressing to farmers and anyone else who would want to fly an unmanned aerial vehicle that they really need to read up on the regulations for sharing airspace and keep abreast of what's going to be changing and coming out of Washington.
What about when we talk about using pesticides, if we're spraying fields with these, is there any concern about what could potentially go wrong there?
I think that the U.S. government, and there's, I suppose, a conversation where EPA would have to get together with FAA, in other words, that regulation for the commercial use of drones in precision ag would involve an environmental and conservation discussion. So I think that's ultimately going to wind up in the rulemaking that comes from the federal government. But because there is some precedent for crop dusting and pesticide spray in Japan, as I mentioned, there at least are applications that can be cited and precedent for that.
Okay, well, get your crystal ball out. What's going to happen? What changes might we see, and when might that happen?
This is going to be something that the market drives, and because there is consumer demand for this, and in our area, some farmers that have got some decently deep pockets compared to perhaps other areas of the country, us being in a rich corn belt, and lots of acres. I mean, we've got these massive farms, and farmers whose time is scarce, I would say that it really is going to be the Midwest farmer and also farmers on the West Coast who are going to drive this. And I would not be surprised that this time next year or the following, we're going to see some limited use of drones over cornfields or soybean fields.
Okay, well, I'm sure there'll be more stories to come. Thank you so much, Peter Gray, for talking with us today.
Yeah, thank you, Ben.
You're very welcome. Peter Gray is a reporter with Harvest Public Media, and that's a collaboration between Midwest public radio stations, including Iowa Public Radio. You can see Peter Gray's report, Drones Coming Soon to a Farm Near You. You can find that at iowapublicradio.org. Well, we're in the middle of a news buzz edition of River to River on Iowa Public Radio. Still plenty more ahead. In the next portion of the program, we'll talk about March Madness and the Iowa college basketball teams. Bryce Miller of the Des Moines Register will be here to cover how the tournaments look and a little about why a person that's not normally a sports fan might be interested in the games and hype. Then a member of the U.S. Sled Hockey Paralympic gold medal team, Andy Yohe, recently returned from Sochi, Russia. He'll tell us about that gold medal final that put the U.S. team up against the Russians. Yohe's from Iowa. And finally, we'll hear about an Iowa teacher who conducted an experiment to show that living entirely off fast food does not mean necessarily gaining weight. In fact, he lost 60 pounds doing just that by watching calories. That's ahead on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.